Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with what we've been discussing recently. We mostly recently talked about On the Waterfront. Before that was The Candidate. Before that was Gentlemen Broncos. Bunch of hotties in a row. And Margaret before that. Yeah, themacguffinman.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
Here we are, talking about the treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Yeah, kind of one that's been on the list for a while.
I mean, yeah, probably since as soon as we were like, hey, let's maybe do some old movies sometime, which was maybe the second month of this podcast when we started doing oldish movies.
Yeah, a 1948 movie. And gee, I was gonna ask how this got on the list, but it was so long ago. I just think of it as kind of one of those classic movies that directors always seem to bring up when they're talking about influences of their modern movies.
Yes, this is a movie that directors love. It's like the I think it was the Sex Pistols that was the band that would inspire a million people to pick up guitars. It seems like this had that effect on a lot of directors for some reason, you know? And I mean, most famously, There Will Be Blood. It was a big inspiration. Steven Spielberg says Dobbs, Humphrey Bogart's character, was a main influence on Indiana Jones. And when Interstellar was out, Christopher Nolan was making the rounds saying that movie, this movie was a big influence on that. And those are three pretty diverse styles of filmmaking, and that's just the three I can think of off the top of my head, you know.
Yeah, and Kubrick said it was one of his favorites.
Oh, yeah, because this is, yeah, Kubrick would love this movie.
Yeah, and then even Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad, said, you know, not only is this part of what made him want to start making entertainment, but even specifically Breaking Bad and Walter White being Frank C. Dobbs here. You know, you can kind of see the through line of just what starts off as just seemingly a normal guy, which we can talk about, but kind of just the slow corrupting influence of greed and money or gold or blue meth or what have you.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that the inspiration most people get out of this movie is mostly in regards to the Dobbs character. But I find this movie works, like, I mean, I'm not breaking ground by saying this. I think the fact that there are three main characters in this movie and each of them is, I mean, not equally interesting, but like, I think there's a really solid argument to make that Howard is the most interesting character in this movie. That's the character played by Walter Houston, who is fucking amazing in this movie. Yeah. And I don't know. I found myself most interested in his character. And naturally, he's like the old wise man of the three, the one who's been through these wars before and maybe come out with a better perspective for it. But I think it's sort of, the movie does an interesting job of, I guess, very quietly implying that maybe he's gone through the same journey Dobbs has before and just sort of found himself with a, you know, at a turning point and making a different decision and sort of coming out of it better for it and also still having his head attached to his body as opposed to Dobbs at the end of this movie. Yeah. Well, implied decapitation, you know.
But. Yeah. Source material is on that side.
Yeah, okay. I wasn't sure if that was in the source material, but that is how John Huston, director and screenwriter of this movie, intended to show Bogart's death. It was a rolling head into the water, but this is 1948. That doesn't fly.
Yeah, and just to go back to what you're saying about the three main characters, I think when we think about Breaking Bad, we think of some of these stories about these, even in gangster movies, which, you know, there's some overlap, but it's definitely a different thing. We watch this demise, you know, we watch this descent into madness or into greed or however to phrase it. Mm-hmm. And all those movies have, you know, a rounded out cast. But I think, especially with something like There Will Be Blood, we get so caught up in this one performance and this one character. And I didn't really know a lot of the specifics about this movie. But I agree with you. I wasn't anticipating it to be as split into thirds as this mm-hmm. is. Now, it's certainly not perfectly into thirds, but it's much more substantially Much less substantially just the Frank C. Dobbs show than I was ready for as well.
Yeah, it's Fred C. Dobbs, but you're thinking of a name that somebody would conceivably be called now as opposed to when people were actually still named Fred in the 1940s. They have all since passed away. But and I think it's been a handful of years since I saw this movie, but I definitely first came at it assuming it was just going to be the Bogey show, the Humphrey Bogart show. And yeah, it just, I think that sort of, that colored my perspective of the movie the first time I watched it. And watching it again a few times for this podcast, I think the movie really, like, I now see the movie that smart people have always seen, whereas I was just watching it like a dummy, I guess, the first time, where I liked it, but didn't find a strong attachment to large portions of it. But I now see the movie as so many others have seen before, you know, and I find it a very interesting movie. And I think that the key to that is the three people, like focusing on the three people as opposed to just Bogart.
Yeah. And I think that would just be, it's so much less interesting because, you know, we speak broadly about these kinds of movies in the TV show that if you have a person and then they have a chance at, you know, wealth or power or fame or whatever it is, that there's this, you know, alluring nature to it that we're powerless over. And I think once we split up the character into a couple different characters to kind of watch what agency people have affect their outcome, then, you know, it's saying something more than just money's bad or gold is bad or greed is bad. And that, you know, this isn't just there's money, therefore someone's going to have a bad time and let's just watch the dominoes fall. I mean, we have Fred at the center here. We have Howard, who maybe, as you said, may have had the same experience as Fred, but is now getting another shot at it and using his knowledge to do something differently.
Yeah, because he's the one who has been a prospector before, and they talk about it when they're in the, I don't know, whatever hostel shelter type place that they are towards the beginning.
Yeah,
of the movie.
Yeah, Fred and Kurt, or Dobbs and Curtin, are, you know, very upfront about the fact that they know nothing. And so Howard's been through it all, but so maybe his age and maybe his experience is what separates him from Dobbs and allows him to make smarter decisions and ultimately end up in a better spot. And we don't know a ton about Curtin before this starts. You know,
no,
Dobbs doesn't even either. They're strangers. But they appear around the same age and they seem to be living somewhat the same life, at least at the time this movie starts. But we just see that different decision making and different levels of greed and, you know, maybe listening to the advice of elders. There is a way that you can coexist with this money. And maybe, as we see with Curtin, it's not even getting it, but seeing what it can do to people is enough to kind of learn your lesson.
Yeah, for sure. And I do think, like, the thing that makes this movie so works so well is the slow burn of it. You know, you see moments in the beginning that, you know, what I'm describing might just be something that's a very 1948 thing that just seems weird to me now. But like, Bogart doesn't have money, or Dobbs doesn't have money to, he's asking people to stake him to a meal, and then he goes and gets a haircut, you know? And I think that could be just a 1948 thing where even the homeless people have to look all right. or it's just showing us a little bit of vanity that lies inside of Dobbs. And after he gets his haircut and gets that shave, he stares in the mirror for a period of time that I would describe as slightly too long. It's more than just a utilitarian glance at yourself to be like, okay, this is fine. My barber did okay. And he seems interested in his appearance. And also right after that, he's very impressed by himself for having a woman turn her head and look at him. And I think, like, that's a small moment where, especially when you don't know where the movie's going to go, I think that adds a lot to Dobbs's character. And I think it plants an important seed for what's to come. And and we mentioned how, you know, Howard's probably been through the same thing before. And basically, I think the movie proposes that you can do something like this, and either you can come out as Dobbs does, or you can come out as Curtin does. And Howard seems to more closely have aligned with Curtin, you know, who, as you said, has a bit of an epiphany at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and maybe they're different people. Maybe it's just an age thing, you know, but you can see that you have some agency in that it's not like it, this isn't a movie just about the overwhelming power of fate, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it sometimes it seems that way. I did want to talk about Dobbs and a lot of the ways they establish that character. And, mm-hmm. you know, he starts by begging, but it seems, you know, we don't know much about him. And I don't think they do this super straightforward, and I like that. I mean, we don't just see him as sort of a white hat. He's a really nice guy who's done everything right, but he's down on his luck, and you know, now he comes up against this unstoppable force of greed or something like that. Because yeah. Well, yeah, I'm still struggling with it a bit myself, so I wanted to see if you could clear anything up. But mm-hmm. so he begs for some money from John Huston, funnily yeah. enough. he gets it, and he ends up asking him for it again. And, you know, this doesn't seem like, I mean, tell me if you got the different sense, but it genuinely doesn't seem like he feels, oh, I've got a sucker, I can hit this guy up for money.
I don't see that at all.
Yeah, exactly. It does seem like a genuine mistake. And so I didn't know if you saw him getting his hair cut as, instead of just buying cigarettes all the time, I will get a haircut and maybe look like someone who is employable. Mm-hmm. And that him getting, you know, the shave and the haircut isn't a superficial thing. It isn't about him wanting to look good or, you know, pick up women, but looking like he could be trusted with a job and looking, you know, kind of dressed for the part you want, the job you want, not for the job you have. And that he is legitimately done mooching off people and he wants to make something for himself.
Yeah. So I think there are a couple small things that I read as sort of playing into my sort of vanity theory about the haircut. Because I do agree that that's definitely a good read of it and definitely also seems logical, you know? But my thinking is that when John Huston says, you know, I've given you money earlier today, two times or whatever, and Dobbs says something along the lines of, sorry mister, I never even saw your face, all I saw was the hand and the money in it. Yeah. I think that is showing what he cares about. It's especially since, to contrast that, Howard spends a lot of time talking about human struggle and just sort of caring about the people behind the gold. He says something like along the lines of, an ounce of gold is worth it because of the human labor that went into it, which is a very like solid separation of those two characters. But Dobbs says he only saw the money. And then there's also I love the construction of the line, because he's not just begging for money. He's not saying, can I have some change? He's saying, would you stake a fellow American to a meal? And he says the same thing every time. And what that implies is, would you bet on me? You know, like, would you stake me? Would you, like, he's implying that by giving me money, it's an investment in, like, the future, you know? And I think, I think that implies a level of self-confidence that I think fits in line with the read that I'm kind of taking from it. Just that. That type of person just sort of lives inside of Dobbs already and is waiting for the gold to sort of bring it out of him, which is what the movie shows us. I certainly don't disagree with your reading. I think both of our readings are valid. Yeah,
no, and I don't even know that it's my reading. I'm still just, you know, kind of chewing on it for a bit, because then he buys the lottery ticket, which mm-hmm. is, I mean, in a way, I guess it's kind of investing in yourself. Mm-hmm. But that's also such a metaphor of, I'm not willing to work and I think I should just be a millionaire.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. That's a good point. And it's almost like that scene is set up in an interesting way, because it's almost like he doesn't immediately want to buy it. He's almost pestered into it. And the boy makes it seem like a little, I don't know, there's a level of enthusiasm behind the boy that it seems like Dobbs might be helping this kid by investing what ends up being a very small amount of money, you know. It's a fraction of his change from his meal and water. So I don't know, because I think if that kid comes up to him and says, hey, do you want to play the lottery, and takes no for an answer, then it's like, cool, that's it, moving on, you know. And he just doesn't play the lottery. But
yeah, and he's kind of investing in this kid's hard work and determination. You know, he sees this child willing to do something other than just hold his hand out, and maybe he, you know, can relate to that quite easily for where he is in life.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and then I just think in the other way that this sets up Dobbs before the movie really gets rolling is after they do go to work building the oil derricks, and they find the man who was supposed to pay them, and they beat him up, and they take just the money that they're deserved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just another way to show that, you know, he's this nice guy, but I just find him, he's a bit more complicated than I thought he would have been off the hop. And even since we kind of have this triumvirate of characters who might represent different things, it's just not quite as easy to categorize this guy as, you know, a lazy American who wants things to come this way. And I don't think that's how John Huston thought of the average American person either. So that fits.
Yeah. I agree. And I do want to mention, since you mentioned the oil derrick scene and the bar fight, I found it fascinating that the bar fight plays out for a pretty long amount of time with no music. There's no music in that sequence, and that's a very non-1948 decision. And I just thought that was worth mentioning. And also, I think one of the things that people attach to themselves to this movie so much for is just the level of scale that exists in it. And the oil derrick scene is a perfect example of it, where they build a goddamn giant oil derrick for a scene that is maybe less than a minute long, you know? And that is such a complicated sequence for so little like actual screen time. And I don't know. Those are two things I wanted to mention just offhandedly about John Huston's decision-making behind the camera or directorial decision-making, you know? Because you could have easily shot that with like some rear screen projection of just stock footage projected behind Bogart, and they're having that same conversation at the oil derrick, and they're like, "Nope, let's build it. You know, let's build it on location and shoot there."
Well, and for a 1940s fight scene, I thought this was pretty good.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Because those are some things that allow you to jump out, jump out of your suspension of disbelief. And again, it's not the most realistic fight scene, but especially for the time, and not necessarily just the realism, but it does go hand in hand with that. Just the fighting that you get in this genre, in this time period around the 40s and 50s, you often that cowboy cartoon violence where it's just guys throwing absolute haymakers and kind of slumping over. This one has some desperation and kind of, you know, holding on people's legs and just what I imagine an ugly bar fight at the time would look a lot more like than what we get on television around that time.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
films during that time.
Yeah, something I'm sure John Huston and Humphrey Bogart were well versed in together.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to mention about timing quickly too is just how it always just seems when we're making movies about this time period that we are 100 years away from it. And this is a 1948 movie about 1926 or 27 or something. And that's just another thing that I find is interesting, that this is this is about us making a movie from the 80s. You know, it's not something we have a great grip on, but someone who is 60, you know, this isn't out of the realm of their lifetime's understanding.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for somebody like me, who I think you've always been more interested, were more interested in history from a young age than I was, and I feel like that divide is even greater for me. And I think I'm like more like most people, and see that divide is even greater than somebody like you sees it.
Yeah.
So like to have you comment on that, I feel like really, really means something, you know. Whereas like sometimes I see something from 1989 and it could have, I don't know, it looks like as old as 1889 to me, but you know, I do always find the historical aspects of these movies interesting for the time-based reasons that I can just never understand contextually. Like, gotcha. I think that the haircut would just play totally different in 1948 as opposed to the four different readings or whatever we've said of it by now, you know. I think let's continue on talking about Dobbs, just because I think we started it on his arc. We might as well continue on it.
Sure.
I think it's really, I don't know, we get basically, once they start to actually search for gold, they find gold. You know, there's some interesting Howardisms along the way, but I found it interesting how quickly, once they find gold, the perspective of the movie, or sorry, the paranoia sort of starts to set in. Pretty much immediately, Dobbs is concerned that the other people are going to run away with his gold, the other people being Howard and Curtin. And even when, in that first scene where Howard is measuring out the gold, they're having a conversation. I don't remember what the topic of the conversation is about, but very casual conversation. And Howard is measuring out the gold. But once he starts measuring out the gold, we stop getting two shots of Howard and Dobbs in the same frame. Dobbs is lying down, and it's just sort of framed from above Howard looking down on him, and switch to close-ups. So the characters become isolated in the frame as soon as Howard starts measuring the gold. And I think that's a small filmmaking decision that I think really shows the isolation that's very quickly starts to set in with these characters. And soon after that, we have Dobbs waking up, and it's Howard has gone to check on the donkeys, the burros, if you will. And Howard just immediately is like, I gotta go check on my gold, you know? And that sets off this whole scene. It's a chain of events of Bob eventually doing the same thing, and then and then Dobbs coming back while Bob is gone, and then him being double paranoid, and I don't know, just the speed with which that type of thing sets in this movie, I think is really interesting. Like the hints of what are to come, again, start very early on.
Yeah, and just the fact, as you said, the way that he's shot in just one shot when he's weighing it up. You know, Dobbs is not even just lying down, but kind of looking lying down in a way that he can't even see what everybody else is up to, even though they're handling his gold, which is a much different Dobbs than we come to know and love. Yeah,
there's so many haircuts in that bag of gold dust.
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, those scenes were kind of what I was expecting to see, sort of wall to wall and kind of everybody falling down.
Yeah. Yeah.
That temptation.
Yeah, I agree. And I sort of, that was my view of the movie, like from afar before I saw it. And I think the movie takes the two biggest strengths of the movie are it taking a long time to get to that point, and then it having a long resolution after they leave their mine, or wherever, if are we calling it mining? I know they do mine, but like the whatever trough they set up, I don't quite know what that's called. I don't think we call it troughing. But once they leave that setup, I think like there's still a good chunk of time when they leave, and I think that's the real strength of the movie, is that it shows the beginning and it shows the ending in great detail, you know, as opposed to the whole just very quick rise and fall.
Yeah. Did you get some Lost City of Zed vibes as well?
Yes, a little bit for sure. I mean, this movie is so influential that I wish I had kept a list of every movie it reminded me of, like I did with Marlon Brando and all the Waterfront, and all the actors he reminded me of. But I don't know. I feel like if I watched it again, just looking for things that has influenced, I would have a hard time keeping up with writing down all the notes, you know?
Yeah. Anything more to say about Curtin?
I do have a little bit more to say about Curtin, just because I think it ties into the resolution of the movie, basically Howard and Curtin sort of coming together. So maybe we should just talk about Dobbs's downfall first, and then talk about Howard and Curtin. Do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. And I'll just say, just before we get to that part, just to you know, I kind of talked about Dobbs as maybe the everyman American character. Just to flesh out his beginning a bit more, I mean, he begs, and then he you know, he tries to work. You know, he we see him kind of rely on big business. There's this big company that, you know, the oil company that he goes and works for. And then we kind of get this sense that corporate America screws him over, doesn't really get the money he was deserved. And then that's when there's this American self-reliance. You know, he's just going to go with some people he knows, with some money he's saved up, and go and try to find all this stuff for himself. And just the fact that they have to be extra hidden about it because they're not going about it the legal way just really reinforces the solitary nature of who they are and what they're doing and how they're going about getting their wealth when the other ways failed them.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And but going back to Dobbs and, like, you know, as we discussed, there's a sort of a big chunk of the movie where characters are kind of just they're mining for gold. They're dealing with various paranoia setting in. But once the movie starts to progress, particularly after Howard leaves them to go care for that that boy, that's when it really takes a ratchets up into some very, like, abstract turns for a movie from this time period. I mean, I could talk about the Tiger Roar for conservatively 45 minutes, but just the when Bob and Dobbs are starting to travel together, and I think Bob suggests maybe they separate, and Dobbs is immediately like, "Well, then you just follow me and kill me from behind or whatever." And yeah, that sequence ends with them just obviously not trusting each other to not kill each other. And Dobbs says, I will bet all of our money, $105,000, that I can stay awake longer than you. And we get this pull away from the camera of them at a campfire, and they're clearly going to just be in a staring contest all night.
Yeah.
And Dobbs,
until one of them falls asleep, it is immediately shot in the
head. Exactly. And Dobbs starts laughing maniacally. It's just so villainous sounding and so, like, outside of Humphrey Bogart's star image. I think that's something that I love so much about the third act of this movie, is just how you know, I can't view Humphrey Bogart from how a moviegoer in 1948 viewed him, but as somebody who is 50 years removed from his greatest works, like, or his most famous works, like, this is not the Humphrey Bogart we have in our head, which it's Casablanca and Maltese Falcon are, like, the two Bogart roles to me. And I don't know, he's just so, he looks so mangy at the end, and yeah, that laugh that he has a couple times is just, it's so far removed from, like, the collected Humphrey Bogart that we I think just anticipate viewing from afar. And I think that sequence is great, and just the way it continues on when he shoots Bob, that's when we really get this, like, him devolving into the person we have at the end of this movie, where, you know, he's shot him, and then he's paranoid about whether or not he actually killed him, but doesn't want to go and check on him. And then he lies down at the fire and says, "Oh, the fire doesn't give much heat." And I think that's a really nice line, because, you know, it's sort of like, I think that's meant to imply that the thing that he was searching for, is, you know, a fire is a stand-in for gold, and it doesn't give him what he wants. It only, as Howard said towards the beginning of the movie, it only made him want more, and he just wants a bigger fire. And by the end of that scene, he's overcome with a larger fire. But, you know, he's talking about how, if you've got a conscience, it'll pester you to death. I think this is a direct quote. If you've got a conscience, it'll pester you to death. And if you don't believe you got one, what can it do to you? It makes me sick, all this talking and fussing about nonsense. And then just this fire overtakes him, the fire that he's lying in front of. And I think that's meant to show us that, like, the person that Dobbs was is just gone. He's just been, I don't know, he's caught on fire, I guess, you know? And I don't know, I think that whole sequence is so, it's so dark, and it ratchets up some abstraction in a way that I found fascinating. And I'd be curious to know if you felt the same way about it.
Yeah, no, I did. And I think I was reading some of that line, some of those lines about the fire, as the disconnect between Dobbs and nature, which isn't played up super strongly, but kind of gets dropped in every once in a while, because he's not overly flippant about environmentalism or anything, and it's the 40s/20s, so you know, it's just not the same topic as it was. But we see Howard is so wise in so many ways. I mean, he seemingly knows how this movie ends. Well, he's at the start of it. Yeah. You know, he teased them up so well for the path they're going to go down. So he seems wise about human nature, but he also knows so much about nature itself and where they are and what's fooled goals and what's animals or which, and, you know, how to move in a way that people can't track you, and just so many different things. And Even when they read the letter of the man who, Russell, maybe the guy who follows them, who ends up dying.
In my notes, he's just fourth guy.
Okay.
So fourth I think guy. His name might be James Cody. I'm looking at the Wikipedia right now.
Okay.
But, yeah. Oh yeah, it is Cody. It's Cody.
Okay. There we go. So we'll go with Cody. You know, he reads the letter, which is from the man's now widow. And we're supposed to see that as a pretty bad loss, you know, for all I'm saying about this movie having a lot of gray, which I do like about it. That guy, we're supposed to walk away with the feeling he was just very hard done by and that he was a good man trying to provide for his family. Yes. And got the worst of it, right?
Yep, for sure.
And so we read his letters, and his wife talks about the trees and how she's been watching the seasons change, and you know, about how beautiful it is and how she wants him back. And even, you know, not just Howard, but Curtin too seems to take some time to appreciate nature and to learn a lot of things, where you know, he even says something about what he wants to do with his money was something like retire and just watch the nature and watch the trees change color. And Dobbs just wants to be a dick to waiters, like that's his plan for the money. So I mean, right there is the kind of the clearest indication. But there is this pervasive sense that people who don't know or don't respect anything about the natural surroundings that is giving them the wealth, you know, it's going to come back to bite them. And we see the same thing with the Mexican natives there. Like, they seem to have a pretty peaceful life where they live with nature, that even, you know, tempts Howard to go and join them for an extreme amount of time that he seems to enjoy. So that was just one other thing about the fire not being warm enough for him, that maybe he's not really a part of our world, or there is just some disconnect between him and physical reality, which speaks to some of his, I think, ethical imbalances.
Yeah, and I think what ties into that is that Howard earlier on, when Dobbs and Curtin feel like they've found gold before they actually have found gold, and they start pouring water on rocks, as Howard's up ahead of them, Howard comes back and he's like, no, that's not gold. That's just these little flecks. They mean nothing. But he says something along the lines of water's priceless. Sometimes it's more priceless than gold. And, you know, water also an element, you know? And I think that sort of ties into what you're talking about, where Dobbs is just sort of, it's this part of nature that Dobbs is just spilling all over the place, you know?
Yeah, so. And Curtin sees the Gila monster, and you know, Dobbs sees nothing but money, and then we get a good visual metaphor of when he does lift up that rock, that it is this deadly animal and a bunch of money. So
sure.
You know, but it's also different things for those two different people.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the last chunk of Dobbs's arc that I really want to talk about is the next morning, when he talks himself out of burying Bob. He's like, should I go back for him? No, the buzzards will eat him in a week, because he doesn't want somebody else to find his body. But then he says the buzzards or vultures will eat him in a week. And then he hears a tiger roar. It's like a donkey sound mixed with a tiger roar, which is fantastic. And because that, you know, donkeys are the animals that are actually near him. And he's like, oh, that's a tiger. I don't know what's getting into me. And then he decides to go look for this body. And there's this long take of the camera on a dolly, just sort of like roaming around from side to side as Dobbs moves looking for Bob, and his body is no longer there. He crawled away in the night because he wasn't dead. And the way the camera follows him is so interesting, because it's just so much movement that seems directionless, and it just really shows what Dobbs is going through. He's sort of like frantically searching without direction, and I thought that was a really cool choice. And also a very good moment of performance by Bogart, because he has to do this, like, continue just turning into the Dobbs at the end of the movie as opposed to Dobbs at the beginning of the movie. And he's doing so much of that during this shot. And the shot ends with him talking about how convincing himself that the tiger dragged Bob back to his lair, the tiger that surely does not exist, in case I have not made that clear enough, but dragged Bob back to his lair. And then the way he ends that sentence is saying done as if by order, like he's controlling this tiger somehow.
Yeah.
To carry this this body away. And soon after that, Dobbs is dead. But I don't know. I loved that sequence. Loved it. It's like a minute, but it's probably the best minute in this movie.
Yeah. And as you were saying about this not being a bogey performance, this is not at a time when seemingly he would have to do anything he didn't want to in his career. Yeah. Yeah. And he plays, he's the star and he doesn't make it all the way to the end of the film. Mm-hmm. Kind of a lot of different interesting A-list celebrity choices in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. And this is post Maltese Falcon, post Casablanca, post The Big Sleep, and he's past what would eventually be the prime of his career. You know, I think this is like the last movie that would be included in like the prime Bogart sort of period. And I was just doing a little bit more research on John Huston. I've never seen The African Queen, but Humphrey Bogart stars in that. It's the movie he won his Oscar for. And what I saw that was shot in color, I was just like, oh, I don't even know how I could possibly look at a picture of Humphrey Bogart in color. Like, I just don't see it. And I just sort of think that's, I found myself very interested in his star image in this movie and how it portrays him. And just the fact that, like, the idea of I can imagine, like, various other actors from the time period as being seen in color, but for whatever reason, Bogart's strictly black and white, you know, even though we've been spending a lot of time talking about the depth of his character in this movie.
Yeah, and where you kind of saw this on, I mean, we were talking about On the Waterfront, which is not made too far from this. And
yeah, 4 years later.
Yeah, where filmmaking changes, and this, I don't know, I think it kind of occupies a bit of a middle ground as well, because some of this stuff is still like you would imagine it on stage and voice projection and over the top. Mm-hmm. But you know, they shot on location for this one of the first times a Hollywood movie shot on location outside of the US.
Yes.
And it does seem like this is not just the noir back lots of shadows and, you know, small storytelling that we would get from other Humphrey Bogart movies.
Yeah. And we probably about 6 months ago talked about Ace in the Hole, which is another movie. I think that's 1951, a Billy Wilder film. Another movie that we noted for shooting on location within the United States, probably. Was that in Nevada? I don't remember where that movie was, but just we talked a lot about how interesting it was seeing all these camera techniques from the time period with location shooting. And I think that was half of our podcast on the Waterfront. But this one is a notable first in that a lot of it was shot outside of America. And even the stuff that is clearly shot on studio lot with rear screen projection, a lot of the stuff at the beginning, you know, it's clearly rear screen projection, but it feels like the best anybody can do rear screen projection. Like, yeah. It looks really, I don't know, there's a depth to the images that feels uncommon from how I tend to remember what these things look like. And I don't know, I just thought that was really, really cool as well.
Nice. And so how about the end of Curtin's arc and Howard's?
Yeah, I think so. We've kind of been talking about Howard and Curtin a little bit, and just the way that Howard is so at peace with everything always is great. And he has that whole monologue where he sums up the movie, talking about how it's like a cruel, when gold dust was basically thrown away by the bandits that killed Dobbs, because they just sort of thought it was dirt weighing down the donkeys that they wanted. And Dobbs and Curtin and Howard find out, as they get into town, as these bandits are being murdered, they go through coincidentally a dust storm to the place where all this gold dust is now flying around in the air. And Howard talks about how it's this joke played on them by fate or God or nature or whatever. He goes on this long talk about it, and the end of it is just how he talks about how it's this joke played on them by nature. And his one of his last lines is him saying, it's worth 10 months of suffering and labor, this joke is. And Like, they just have him and Curtin have a good laugh. And I feel like Dobbs would have murdered everybody around him if he would, had still been alive for that sequence. And I just sort of, I think that's, that really plays into everything we've talked about with Howard, is just that he's like, well, it, you know, we tried something, it didn't work. I'm still alive. Let's keep it moving. You know, I could see, he's a very glass half full sort of gentleman. I don't know. It's in general. I know he has somewhere that he can go as well, so that sort of plays into the optimism that he has. But Curtin is basically another option for what Dobbs could have been. And Dobbs and Curtin, he vocalizes that he's not that much worse off now than he was when they were in Tampico before they started this whole thing. And he just sort of has the clarity to understand that you know, he thought he wanted this, but you know, all he wants is enough to work at a peach farm, basically. And so he goes off to, Howard stakes him his way back to Dallas to go work on a peach farm with the condition that he goes and talks to Cody's widow, tells her what happened. Who Cody's widow, coincidentally in her letter wrote that no material wealth is worth these long absences, and something along the lines of, we've already found life's real treasure, implying that the family is the life's real treasure. And I think that's really interesting. Not interesting because it's kind of like where I like to think I would end up. I strongly suspect I would have more Dobbs in me than I would like, but you know, everybody watching this movie certainly would want to believe that they would end up like Howard or Curtin as opposed to Dobbs. But I just found that really interesting. And also the actor that played Bob Curtin, do you know much about him? His name's Tim Holt. Did you do any research on him?
Only a little bit.
Okay, so he was an actor who was in a lot of Westerns. I think he might have been in a series of like serialized Westerns. And then he went off to World War II, came back, and was in some more movies, but ended up distancing himself from Hollywood in the 50s, I think. And ended up like selling advertisements for a radio station in Oklahoma. Like that was his career, and it was all by choice. And
yeah, and even when he was working, wasn't he kind of, he would rather be an action star in B movies than be a sort of a side character in the big films?
Yes, I think that was kind of what it was. Because you know, looking at the movies that he was in, there, even just the titles feel like they were made up in like a comedy about this period, like Hail Caesar. If they were listing all of the movies that. his name's escaping me now, but Baby Han Solo that he was in. It read like a series of titles from that. And I found that really interesting. And when he talked about the career he left behind, he would still act from time to time. He would also, like in movies, and he would also work in like local stage performances and stuff as well. So he still liked acting, but he didn't like being under control of contracts. And this is partially the era that he was working in. Said something along the lines of, when I started out as an actor, I didn't have control over my life. I was under contract by RKO. Then I went to fight in World War II, and Uncle Sam was telling me what to do. And then I came back and RKO was telling me what to do again. So distancing himself from Hollywood was the only way to get control over his life. And, you know, Hollywood is just viewed as like a gold mine of its own sort, like the gold mine of fame and whatnot, and just him realizing that this is not what he wants. He wants to be selling advertisements in Oklahoma for a radio station, you know. And I just found that like so borderline comically in line with his character that he plays in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Perfect, like, meta casting at a level that couldn't have even really known at that point.
Yes, exactly. We all know John Huston's a genius, but apparently he can read the future. So I just found that so interesting, and I think that is just very important to any reading of this film to sort of look at where the guy playing Curtin went to in his later life, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's great. So thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men, and check back next time.